Vekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a really critical and, let's be honest, often misinterpreted subject in North American history.
Definitely. We're talking about the continuous, very complex experience of Native Americans.
And our lens for this deep dive is a foundational, really corrective work by historians Theda Perdue and Michael D. Green, North American Indians.
Yeah, and we're here because, well, for just too long, history has really leaned on this simplistic and, frankly, pretty damaging narrative, you know.
The whole vanishing Indian idea.
Exactly. And our mission today really is to dismantle that myth. The core truth we're pulling from these sources is all about indigenous resilience, strategic adaptation, and this persistent political agency.
That's the key word, agency. And why does this history matter so much now?
Well, I think it's because this book, this perspective, it fundamentally transforms the historical lens, doesn't it? It really does.
It forces you, the listener, to realize that Native history isn't just some tragic footnote or, you know, a prelude to the main American story.
Mm-hmm.
It is a central, continuous, and still ongoing part of the American story. It's like a 500-year history of negotiation, survival, and that constant fight for self-governance.
And to really appreciate that shift, that change in perspective, we kind of have to look at the authors themselves, the collaboration behind the book.
Right.
So you have Theda Perdue. She's a highly distinguished historian, particularly known for her deep work on Cherokee history.
Mm-hmm.
But her really great contribution, I think, is her focus on gender analysis and looking at cultural continuity within indigenous societies.
And that's such a key detail, isn't it? Because, you know, traditional colonial histories, they almost always focus just on male leaders' treaties.
Right, the sort of great man view of history.
Mm, exactly. But Perdue's work makes sure we see the whole structure, the entire society. That includes the roles women played in political life and economic life, which often just completely challenges the standard European view of where power lies.
Totally. And then you pair her with her co-author, Michael D. Green. He brought this deep expertise in political history, specialized in southeastern tribes like the Creek or Muskogee, and really understood the complexities of federal Indian policy.
So their combination, it's like decades of deep research coming together.
It is, and that's why they're so uniquely qualified, I think. They combine that essential macro-political analysis, you know, the big picture of U.S. policy, with these incredibly detailed, deeply researched insights into cultural and gender dynamics.
Which allows them to synthesize, what, 5 centuries of really complex history?
Yeah, and while doing that, they consistently emphasize the sheer diversity among hundreds of distinct nations. They push back hard against generalization.
And central to how they do that, you mentioned, is this method historians call ethnohistory.
Right, and ethnohistory, it isn't just like using native sources alongside European ones.
Okay.
It's about shifting the actual questions you ask. It means prioritizing indigenous perspectives, their own structures of knowledge, think kinship networks, oral traditions, rather than just relying only on the letters and treaties written by the colonizers.
That makes a lot of sense. So the book isn't just sort of slotting indigenous people into the existing American timeline.
Oh, not at all.
It's more like building a new timeline from the ground up using their perspective.
Precisely. And the core purpose is corrective.
Mm-hmm.
It replaces that that easy passive victim narrative with this really complex account.
Mm.
It shows indigenous peoples as active agents who were constantly shaping their encounters with colonizers.
So the big question they're tackling is,
yeah,
well, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. How did Native American societies manage to navigate 5 centuries of just catastrophic change, invasion, disease removal, and still maintain their cultural integrity and political autonomy?
It's an incredible question. And the book guides us through that journey. It starts way back, showing the immense diversity of pre-contact societies.
Which is so important.
Then moves through those first colonial encounters, the trauma of removal, forced assimilation. And crucially, it doesn't stop there. It concludes with contemporary struggles for sovereignty and self-determination.
It's the history of nations that just refuse to be erased.
Exactly. And you said it, we need to start right there before contact to really establish that agency from the beginning.
Absolutely. We have got to challenge that empty wilderness myth right out of the gate. Before 1492, North America was, well, it was teeming with complex civilizations.
I was just fascinated by the deep dive into places like Cahokia.
Oh, yeah. Cahokia is amazing.
This huge, sophisticated city, basically, of the Mississippian culture near modern-day St. Louis. Massive trade networks, monumental architecture. It wasn't primitive at all.
Not even close. Or think about the advanced architecture and astronomy of the ancestral Puebloans out west, places like Chaco Canyon. These weren't just isolated bands of nomads. These were settled, highly developed societies with complex governance, deep spiritual practices.
And because they had this strength, this complexity, when contact finally happened, it wasn't immediately just simple conquest. The authors really stress this.
Yeah, those early interactions, they were often about negotiation, mutual adaptation, even if it was unequal adaptation, definitely.
A great example of that agency, that strategic thinking in action, has to be the Iroquois League, the Haudenosaunee.
Absolutely. Their sophisticated political structure, their diplomacy, it allowed them to, well, skillfully play the French and the English against each other for centuries.
Creating a buffer zone, basically.
Exactly. Maintaining significant power. They used those European rivalries to their own strategic advantage, trying to maintain their independence.
But that whole strategy of adaptation, it wasn't just about high-level diplomacy, was it? It was also about survival on the ground, which brings us tragically to the 1830s.
Indeed. This is where the pressure just ramps up incredibly. Interactions transform from, you know, difficult negotiations to outright state-sponsored campaigns of ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
The policy of Indian removal, it wasn't some unfortunate side effect of expansion. It was calculated.
Yeah.
It was driven by greed for land, demanding the removal of indigenous peoples from those resource-rich eastern lands.
And the Cherokee Nation becomes the sort of heartbreaking case study here, doesn't it? It demonstrates the failure of trying to accommodate.
Completely. They did everything right according to Western standards.
Mm-hmm.
They adopted a written constitution, took up farming, built a modern economy. They even used the colonizers' own legal system.
And they won. They actually won at the Supreme Court in Worcester v. Georgia.
They won the legal battle, yes. But President Andrew Jackson just ignored it. Famously, supposedly said something like, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it.
Wow. Such blatant disregard.
Utter political betrayal.
Yeah.
And that led directly to the forced migration we know as the Trail of Tears. The authors show this wasn't just physical hardship, which was immense.
Unimaginable.
It was a profound, deep trauma that fractured communities. And it showed really starkly that no amount of cultural adaptation or political maneuvering seemed like it could withstand that relentless American expansionism.
And that federal betrayal, that level of trauma, it really set the stage for the period the authors call the nadir.
Which is Latin for the lowest point.
Right. The decades following the Civil War, say 1865 to 1900, this was just a systematic, coordinated assault on indigenous identity itself through official government assimilation policies.
And the most devastating tool they used here was probably the boarding school system.
Mm-hmm.
The philosophy was explicit, and it's chilling. It was captured by that motto, kill the Indian and save the man.
It's just horrific to even say.
It is. These schools forcibly removed children from their families. Punished them brutally for speaking their own languages, for practicing their cultures. They were designed to sever those essential bonds of kinship and community.
And happening at the same time, you have the Dawes Act of 1887, the allotment policy.
Right. And this wasn't just about taking more land, although it did that very effectively. It was an intentional cultural weapon.
Yeah, so.
It was aimed squarely at destroying the two foundational pillars of most indigenous societies.
Yeah.
Communal land ownership and kinship bonds.
Okay. That connection is crucial.
Absolutely. Indigenous societies, by and large, relied on collective ownership, on mutual support within the community, within the kinship network. So by breaking up that shared tribal land into little individual parcels, the government tried to force indigenous people to become individual capitalist farmers.
Undermining the whole tribal structure.
Exactly. Destroying the community fabric. And predictably, it led to the massive loss of about two-thirds of the remaining tribal land base by the early 20th century. It was a disaster.
Just an attempt to completely unravel native societies from the inside out. Yet, remarkably, the story doesn't end there. It couldn't be the lowest point forever.
No, thankfully. The history continues, and it continues with resurgence. The tide finally started to turn, albeit slowly, in the 20th century. A major shift was the Indian Reorganization Act, IRA, of 1934.
Often called the Indian New Deal.
Right, under John Collier. And this marked the first time the U.S. government officially, formally, backed away from that explicit goal of tribal elimination and total assimilation. Instead, it actually started to promote tribal self-governance to some extent.
That's a huge policy reversal, even if flawed in practice sometimes.
It was. And it kind of set the stage, maybe unintentionally, for the powerful reawakening that came decades later, the Red Power movement in the 1960s and 70s.
Right, a much more assertive movement.
Definitely. This movement demanded the restoration of treaty rights, demanded full self-determination. You had events like the occupation of Alcatraz in 69.
Which really captured national attention.
It did. It brought Native issues back onto the national political stage with a new kind of force and visibility.
In this resurgence, this persistence, it leads us right up to the present day. The authors make it clear that Native history is absolutely ongoing.
It's not history, it's current events.
Exactly. We see contemporary proof of that strategic survival everywhere. Think about the economic impact of tribal gaming, for instance.
Huge economic engine for many nations, or dedicated language revitalization programs trying to undo the damage of the boarding schools.
And of course, the current legal and environmental struggles. Things like the fights over pipelines, Standing Rock being a major recent example, or treaty fishing rights disputes in the Pacific Northwest.
It shows that strategic adaptation, that fight for sovereignty, it's continuous, it's political, it never stopped.
So that deep history spanning centuries, it really crystallizes into, I think, four core messages that Perdue and Green drive home.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And first and foremost, absolutely central is Native agency. The pillar of the whole work is that Native peoples were rational, strategic actors. They made calculated decisions for survival. They weren't just passive victims swept away by history.
This is so key because it changes the entire dynamic of how you view American history, doesn't it?
Completely.
You stop seeing it as this predetermined conquest, this inevitable wave, and you start seeing it as a prolonged, really complex struggle. Power shifted, treaties were fought over, renegotiated. It required constant strategic thinking from indigenous leaders.
And secondly, there's diversity and complexity. We just have to reject that monolithic, generalized image of the Indian.
Please. Yeah.
Identity is rooted in specific peoplehood. It's about belonging to a particular nation. Cherokee, Lakota, Haida, Hopi, and in specific kinship networks. You just can't talk about the history of the Diné Navajo the same way you talk about the Mashpee Wampanoag on the East Coast.
Their histories, their challenges, their specific treaty rights, they're inherently different. Understanding that diversity is vital for understanding current politics, too.
Okay, third theme. Cultural adaptation and continuity. This one is fascinating. The authors argue really powerfully that adaptation, whether it was adopting new technologies like horses or guns or using new diplomatic strategies, was itself a strategy for survival. It wasn't a sign of cultural loss or weakness.
Right. It wasn't about becoming less indigenous. The strategic change was almost always aimed at strengthening core indigenous values and ensuring survival.
Like the Plains tribes integrating the horse, not just as transport, but into their entire cultural and spiritual framework.
Or, as we'll discuss more, the Cherokee adopting a written constitution and a newspaper. These were acts of strategic cultural endurance, of using new tools to protect their identity, not assimilate into oblivion.
And finally, the fourth big one, maybe the overarching theme. The entire post-contact history is framed by the fact that sovereignty is the defining struggle.
Absolutely. From 1492 onwards, it's a continuous fight for self-determination, for the right of these distinct nations to govern themselves.
And that's the lens you really need to understand. Pretty much every modern debate involving Native nations, jurisdiction, land claims, resource rights, treaties, it all comes back to sovereignty.
It does.
Okay, let's pull out some specific insights, maybe some lines or ideas from the text that really capture these themes well.
Good idea.
The first one, really nailing that agency theme. Native peoples were not passive victims of European colonization, but active participants in the creation of colonial America. That just reframes everything. Colonization was a negotiation, however brutal, however unequal, not simple domination from day one.
Yeah, that's powerful. And then capturing the brutal reality of that nadir period, the assimilation era. Federal Indian policy in the late 19th century was an all-out assault on the very foundations of indigenous identity, the communal ownership of land and the bonds of kinship.
Ugh, it just connects the attack on land so directly to the deliberate destruction of family, community, and culture.
It does. But then, the ultimate refutation of that whole vanishing myth is captured in a line like this. The story of Native Americans is one of political resurgence and cultural renaissance, proving that Indians have not vanished, but have persisted.
Persistence, that resilience again.
Exactly. And, you know, to put a human face on that concept, that strategic cultural adaptation we talked about, we really have to revisit Sequoia.
The Cherokee silversmith, right, who created the Cherokee syllabary, their written language, in the 1820s.
Yes. That is such a fascinating example. His creation of a writing system, arguably the ultimate Western technology at the time, demonstrates perfectly how indigenous peoples could adopt a new tool not to become more like the colonizers.
But to fiercely strengthen their own traditional culture, promote literacy in Cherokee, and bolster their political resistance against the U.S. government's removal policies.
It's an incredible story of indigenous innovation for indigenous purposes.
It really is. So these historical insights, these themes, they aren't just academic, are they? They have very real practical applications for you, the listener, today.
Absolutely. First, I think the book really equips you to critically analyze and, frankly, deconstruct media stereotypes.
Oh, definitely. In movies, TV shows, sports mascots, popular culture.
All of it. You can move from just passively consuming those often inaccurate, often harmful images to actively seeking out authentic indigenous voices and narratives. It helps you ask whose story is being told here and by whom.
And crucially, this history fundamentally changes how you understand contemporary policy debates.
Yes. Those current debates, whether it's about tribal gaming rights or environmental protection efforts like the fight over pipelines or ongoing land claims, they are not isolated incidents.
They're not just random news items?
No. They are the latest chapter in that ongoing 500-year struggle over land, resources, and fundamentally, sovereignty. Knowing the history gives you the context.
And that knowledge, it leads directly to more informed civic engagement, doesn't it? Understanding the unique legal and political status of Native nations as domestic dependent nations.
Which is that specific, kind of complex term coined by the Supreme Court way back in the 1830s.
Right. It means they are recognized as distinct political entities, as sovereign, but ultimately subordinate to the federal government. And understanding that explains why tribal governments relate directly to the federal government, not usually the state governments, and why upholding treaties isn't just about historical sentimentality.
It's a matter of law. It's about honoring legal agreements between nations.
So, wrapping things up, thinking about the biggest takeaways, what the authors emphasize again and again, I think, is that the defining characteristic of the indigenous experience across all that diversity and trauma is endurance, persistence.
Yes, it's absolutely not a finished story. We have to hold both things in our minds at once. The recognition of the immense historical trauma, the betrayal, the violence, the loss, alongside the ongoing profound cultural vitality and political resilience. It's a story of strategic survival and this continuous drive for self-governance.
And for me, I think the biggest surprise, or maybe the most provocative insight, was realizing just how central change and adaptation have always been to Native survival. It wasn't about staying frozen in time.
Mm-hmm.
This history actually provides these incredible models, really, for any community facing marginalization on how you can advocate for your interests, adapt to immense pressure while fiercely maintaining your core cultural integrity.
That's a great point. So perhaps we can leave you, the listener, with this final thought to mull over. Just consider how much more complete, how much more honest your understanding of American history becomes when you stop seeing Native peoples as obstacles or footnotes and instead recognize them as central, continuous actors who have forever shaped and continue to shape what it even means to be American.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ocotra Foundation.